talking about the Revolutionary War and the Civil War as though they were wars fought on American soil, supposedly for freedom and democracy. But as he says, if these two wars were really fought for freedom and human dignity for all men, why are 20 million of people of African descent still confined and enslaved here in America to second-class citizenship? I'm Mimi Rosenberg. You've been listening to Malcolm X, The End of White World Supremacy. Support our stations, WBAI, WPFW. Go to your phone now and ask for Malcolm X, The End of White World Supremacy. Thank you so much for listening. Stay strong. Stay well. It's that we get strong.
Men got fixed. They didn't want to see black men progress. All along the way, we have strayed, searching to find the way to happiness. How long will it be till all of my brothers prospect. It was to see all men live in unity, but now he is down in the grave. Where can the killers be found? I want to know how long will it be till all of my brothers see the hidden brutality. Well, oh Malcolm, oh Malcolm X, down in the crowd, killer name was be found. It was to see all men live in a unity, but now he is down in the grave. Where can the killers be found? Just let me know.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York. It's a couple of minutes past 9 p.m. High time for the joy of resistance with Fran Locke and Halsey Hazard.
Joy of resistance. We're sisters of the joy of resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy of resistance. We have found this joy in resistance. For those who gain by keeping women down, we say your numbers up, don't underestimate our persistence. We're keeping organized together. We have come a long distance. Joy, joy of resistance. Sisters of the joy of resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
And good evening. You are listening to the Joy of Resistance Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. We come to you every Monday night, 9 to 10 p.m., and we bring you the best. We bring you the most profound and in-depth current news reporting that we can on what's going on with the worldwide struggle of women. So tonight, we've got two very exciting guests. First, we're going to be speaking with Jessica Mason-Pieglo, who's an activist attorney, a Supreme Court watcher. She's Senior Vice President and Executive Editor of Rewire News Group. And we're going to be talking about the flood of anti-abortion bills currently all vying with each other to be taken up by the Supreme Court in the hopes that one of them will be the case that will lead to the overturning of Roe versus Wade. And Jessica's going to kind of try to clear some of the fog around all of that. In our second segment, we're going to be talking about commercial surrogacy. The bill has just been legalized, making it absolutely available now to anyone with a lot of money to use. And we have heard a lot of sort of puff pieces for it. Tonight, we're going to hear the other side. Our guest is going to be Tiana May, who's the executive director of the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women and a founding member of Equality Now. We're going to speak about the sexist, racist, and class aspects of commercial surrogacy and why it's outlawed in most of Europe and whether the safeguards built into the New York State bill are actually adequate, as well as the toll it takes on the body of the women acting as surrogates. So we are looking forward to that. And yes, you get all sides on the Joy of Resistance. So we're going to start out, of course, with our feminist news, as we do everywhere. Myself and Halsey Hazard will read it. So we are ready. With a conservative Supreme Court majority of 6-3, there are now 17 separate anti-abortion cases vying to get onto the docket of the Supreme Court in an attempt to set up a legal showdown on the constitutionality of Roe versus Wade, the 1973 Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. Just within the past few weeks, there have been two close calls regarding one of these cases possibly making it onto the court's calendar. A case from Mississippi, Dobbs versus Jackson's Women's Health Organization, is defending its 15-week abortion ban by asking the court to review the, quote, viability standard, close quote, which is the principle built into Roe that says that the state cannot interfere with a woman's choice to have an abortion until a fetus is, quote, viable, that is, able to survive outside of the womb. While medical consensus is that this happens at about 24 weeks into a pregnancy, the Roe decision never specified an exact number. So that is a loophole just waiting to be exploited, as it is being in this case. There's also an important subclause in Dobbs, which asks the court to narrow who could legally challenge abortion restrictions. Currently, doctors and health centers can bring cases to challenge a state abortion law. But the Dobbs case is asking that only the woman be involved, and that would place great financial burdens on individual women and lessen possible challenges. Another anti-abortion bill that is almost made to the Supreme Court is the South Carolina Fetal Heartbeat and Protection from Abortion Act, which would prohibit abortion as soon as cardiac activity of the fetus can be detected, often at 6 weeks, before most women even know they are pregnant, resulting in a de facto abortion ban. On February 20th, just a day after a bill was signed into law by Governor Henry McMaster, that's that bill, a federal court blocked the measure in a suit brought by Planned Parenthood, but only temporarily. A hearing for the ruling is set for March 9th. And in any of these, if any of these 17 bills succeed in making it to the court's calendar and the court rules in their favor, Roe would be overturned and the, quote, trigger laws, laws passed in 10 states that would immediately ban abortions if Roe were overturned, would go into effect. Nine states have laws that if Roe were overturned, would be validated. And seven states that never got rid of pre-Roe abortion bans would also have those bills go into effect. On tonight's show after the news, we'll be speaking with activist attorney and Supreme Court watcher Jessica Mason Pieglo, who will help us understand this complex moment in U.S. abortion rights history.
In other national news, the Joe Biden administration has taken several steps to undo Trump-era setbacks to women's rights and reproductive justice. However, many feminists are concerned that he has not made enough effort to follow through on his ambitious campaign promises. During the 2020 election, Biden issued a detailed agenda for women that recognized as a, quote, women's constitutional right under Roe v. Wade, end quote, and promised to take a variety of steps to enforce that, including enshrining Roe v. Wade in law and overturning the Hyde Amendment, which prevents federal funding from going to abortion providers. On January 28th, he did issue a presidential memorandum on protecting women's health at home and abroad. And this memorandum repeals the global gag rule, which prohibits foreign organizations that receive U.S. funding from even mentioning abortion, restores support for the UN Population Fund, and withdraws the United States' sponsorship of the anti-abortion and anti-LGBTQ Geneva Consensus Declaration, which was signed by Trump's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. On the domestic front, the memo directs the Department of Health and Human Services to consider rescinding regulations that prevent clinics receiving Title X family planning funds from referring patients for abortion services. However, the Biden administration has yet to signal willingness to overturn the Hyde Amendment and many other restrictions, or to put policies in place that will enshrine the right to abortion in law. In an article for Women's Media Center titled, "The Biden Administration's Moves to Protect Abortion Are Good, Just Not Good Enough," international human rights lawyer Michelle Onello wrote, quote, "While the order proclaims support for so-called sexual and reproductive health and rights, without mention of abortion, it says the harms from Trump's extension of the global gag rule was the injury to U.S. ability to work with partners, rather than its violation of a woman's right to access an abortion," end quote. Risa Kaufman, director of U.S. Human Rights at the Center for Reproductive Rights, writes that, quote, "Biden could have indicated his concern for abortion rights by repealing Executive Order 13-535, which reinforces abortion restrictions in Obamacare. He could have repealed or revised amendments that restrict abortion access, lifted restrictions placed on medication abortions, expressed support for the Global Health Empowerment and Rights Act, and repudiated the Commission on Unalienable Rights and the Fetal Tissue Advisory Board," end quote. It is clear that activists still have work to do to ensure that Biden takes bold, decisive action to protect abortion. Joy of Resistance will continue to track the Biden administration's progress on women's rights and to highlight the work of feminist activists fighting to defend and expand abortion access.
Okay, and you are listening to the Joy of Resistance, multicultural feminist news, and I should say multicultural feminism at WVAI. And this is our feminist news with which we begin every show, and we track the many, many battles being fought so that women can have full legal rights around the globe. Okay, in New York State, the New York State Surrogacy Act was ratified by the Senate on February 3rd after having been passed by the New York State Assembly in April of 2020. The bill legalizes commercial surrogacy, meaning the paying of women to become pregnant and bear children for clients willing to pay them. While being hailed as a great step forward, some feminist legislators voted against the bill, such as Assemblywoman Deborah Glick, Helene Weinstein, and Dede Barrett, all of whom received a public tongue-lashing from Governor Cuomo, who pushed hard for the bill's passage. Other prominent feminists, including Gloria Steinem and the National Organization for Women, and our guest tonight, Kaina Bien-Ameh, director of the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women, believe there is no way the practice cannot lead to the exploitation of the poorest classes of women. Defenders of the New York surrogacy law reassure us that there are excellent safeguards that protect the rights of women built into the New York state law, and these include the intended parent pays for all attorney's fees and health insurance, including up to a year after the pregnancy. Tonight, we will be hearing the other side of the debate, which you may not have heard before, as we speak with Kaina Bien-Ameh in the second half of our show.
All right, and now for some international news. In a landmark ruling for India's Me Too movement, a court in Delhi has acquitted a journalist of defamation charges after she accused a former government minister of sexual assault. Priya Ramani had faced up to 2 years in jail over an article she had written that accused the former foreign minister and newspaper editor Mobashar Jawed Akbar of sexually assaulting her in a hotel room during a job interview. Though her initial article, which was released in 2017, did not name Akbar, she decided to go public following the growth of the Me Too movement in 2018, and her accusation prompted over 20 other women to come forward with similar allegations. Akbar resigned as a junior external affairs minister, making his case one of the most high-profile Me Too resignations that India has seen so far. Karuna Nundi, a Supreme Court lawyer who helped shape India's anti-rape bill, said, quote, "This victory is significant because it preserves women's right to speak and have published their true Me Too accounts of sexual assault and harassment, even if they choose not to file cases against their harassers. Many won't until we strengthen the system," end quote.
Okay, and moving over to New Zealand. In New Zealand, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern and Associate Education Minister Jan Tinetti have announced that the country will offer free sanitary products to students starting in June, thanks to a new initiative which expands on a pilot program launched last year. The initiative, which aims to combat period poverty, expands on a pilot program that launched last year and provides free products to students at all primary, intermediate, secondary, and Kora, or Maori language, immersion schools. Ardern said that providing free period products at schools is one way for the government to help address poverty, increase school attendance, and support students' well-being. A 2020 report by the charity Kids Can said that up to 20,000 students in New Zealand faced inadequate access to period products because of financial and social constraints, and research suggests that 1 in 12 girl children have missed school as a result. Period poverty is a problem in many parts of the world and has been greatly exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. New Zealand has joined a handful of other countries taking steps to provide menstrual products, following in the footsteps of Scotland and Great Britain, who both introduced similar programs last year.
All right. And in a rare public confrontation over sexism, Japan's former Prime Minister Yoshiro Mori was forced to resign from his position at the head of the Tokyo Olympics Committee after he made sexist remarks, and he has now been replaced by Seiko Hashimoto, the first woman to hold this position. The incident kicked off on February 3rd when Mori responded to a policy requiring 40% of women on the committee by claiming that women are too talkative and make meetings, quote, drag on too long, end quote. His remarks inspired protests and condemnation from politicians, including current Prime Minister Suga Yoshihide. After the controversy, a committee representing an equal number of men and women was formed to find a suitable successor to lead the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, which were rescheduled to July 2021 as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. They chose Hashimoto, who is a former Olympic track cyclist and speed skater, and one of a small number of prominent female politicians in Japan. Sexism is a serious problem in Japan, and attitudes like Mori's are all too common. Japan is ranked 121st out of 153 countries on the World Economic Forum's 2020 Global Gender Gap Index, making it the worst among advanced countries. In politics, women represent only 10% of members in the House of Representatives and 20% of the House of Councilors.
And that is some, only some, of the worldwide feminist news, the news that affects the struggle of women to move forward, and sometimes, unfortunately, reports on the struggle of women being pushed backwards. But we keep track of it here at Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. The news tonight was produced, it was compiled, it was written, and it was read by Fran Luck and Halsey Hazard. When we come back after the news, we're going to be speaking with activist attorney Jessica Mason Pieglo, and we're going to really get into what's going on with all these cases that want to overturn Roe versus Wade, advancing to possibly appearing before the Supreme Court soon. So stay tuned for this very important segment. We have Jessica Mason Fiequo on the line. Jessica, you there?
I'm here. Thanks so much for having me back.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to have you back again. It's been a little while. I don't know how we would understand all of the things that are popping off if you didn't come onto our show once in a while.
That's so sweet. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So, Jessica Mason Fiequo, to introduce you to our audience. You are the Senior Vice President and Executive Editor at Rewire News Group, which is one of the best blogs, or perhaps you call yourself a news group now, on all things about reproductive rights and justice. And you have a very long history of as a journalist. Also, you've written for many, many, many magazines, and you're an avid Supreme Court watcher. And with that, let's just get into trying to look at this situation that is unfolding not at a slow pace but at a gallop lately, with 17 cases wanting to go before the Supreme Court in some kind of showdown, wanting to have a showdown on with Roe versus Wade, and possibly be the one that will overturn it, which has long been a goal of the right. In the introduction, in our introductory news story, I talked about the Dobbs case from Mississippi, and I talked about the South Carolina case, but you probably know much more about both of them than I was able to research, and I'd like for you to, evaluate the situation, including those two cases.
Sure. Well, as you said in the intro, we have a situation unfolding with regards to abortion rights at the Supreme Court that is troubling, to say the least. So there are a bunch of cases that are stacking up that the justices could take. And in fact, they took one abortion-related case today having to do with the Trump-era domestic gag rule on abortion providers. So we know already that the justices are eager to jump into this arena. But you mentioned two cases in particular that really have court watchers concerned. And the first is Jackson versus Dobbs, which is a case out of Mississippi. And that involves a Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban. So lawmakers in Mississippi tried to ban abortion outright at 15 weeks. We know that that is blatantly unconstitutional because that's before viability. Lots of bright lines that the Supreme Court has given us in these areas, but that doesn't matter because lawmakers are teeing up what they see as tests for the conservative justices to try and overturn Roe versus Wade. So really what we have here developing is a question of how quick are the conservative justices going to move to roll back abortion rights, and are they going to try and take a swing at Roe all at once, or will we see an ongoing chipping away that we have throughout the Roberts Court and that you and I have talked about so many times on this show?
Yeah. Well, now this what has been called a flood of cases, which seems like an adequate metaphor, really began around the time that Brett Kavanaugh was appointed to the Supreme Court, and has greatly increased with Amy Coney Barrett joining the court. Mm-hmm. And it's like, the right wing is licking their chops, waiting for a case that the Supreme Court will take. And, of course, that's where the drama is. Will the Supreme Court take these cases? Or will they hopefully be stopped by lower courts from even getting to the Supreme Court? I mean, that's what the court watching is about right now. But, how do you see this playing out? Because it looks pretty dire. It's all, one thinks of all these, a million little fish kind of going to one place, mm-hmm. and they're just all, they're all just ganging up. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, the national landscape looks really rough right now for abortion rights and, frankly, for all issues that progressives care about with the conservative majority on the Supreme Court. This is why, you know, I think for Democrats and progressives, court reform has to be a leading policy issue. We saw Republicans really over the last not just 4 years, but 12 years, really use every political tool in their toolbox to keep judicial vacancies open when it was a Democratic administration and then jam and fill them when it was a Republican administration. So really, we have a political crisis that is fomenting at the courts. And so, you know, the immediate concern is, of course, what happens to people who, and providers, the people who need care and the providers who want to provide that for it. You know, we see some states that are taking some measures to proactively try and protect abortion rights and access in their state. You know, New York has passed some legislation, New Jersey, New Mexico in the Southwest where I am at is making some good moves. But really it is, you know, without some kind of large organized response from Congress in the terms of codifying Roe versus Wade, you know, that would create a floor, for example. Actively moving on judicial nominations, confirming Javier Becerra to Health and Human Services. There are just so many things that are lining up right now that spell trouble for abortion rights, and the Supreme Court is just part of it. But as you said, this really picked up steam with Brett Kavanaugh, and that's really where we've seen, you know, it sort of snowball from there.
Yeah, and it's getting larger, and there's also this kind of cycling that happens where the right wing gets much more active when you have a Democratic administration. And now, of course, that they've got this great prize of the conservatively stacked Supreme Court, you know, they are really licking their chops and trying to move ahead. So I noticed that the Supreme Court did not take that Mississippi case, that 15-week abortion ban, right, in their last conference. I'm starting to learn about how they operate now. Finally, they have conferences, right? And they decide what will come before the court. But from what I can see, we've got another conference coming up on February 26th where they might accept that. Okay,
so exactly right. Like, this is how the sausage is made. So the justices have these conferences, which is basically just like a meeting, right? A conference call where they get together and they decide what cases they're going to take. And there's a big stack of petitions that they go through. And frankly, nobody really knows much about the process because, like everything with the Supreme Court, it is shrouded in secrecy. But the following Monday, sometimes Friday afternoons, but usually the following Monday morning, the Supreme Court releases what's called an order list. And on that order list is detailed the cases that they're going to take and the cases that they've decided not to take. And the justices rarely give their reasoning for deciding to take a case or not take a case unless somebody feels particularly strongly about it. And then they usually write an opinion like we saw Justice Thomas did today in the Pennsylvania election cases. But if they don't do anything, the case just sits there and they think about it and they think about it and they think about it. And that's the case with this Mississippi 15-week abortion ban. This is the fourth time that the justices have considered whether or not they're going to take it, and they haven't acted on it. What does that mean? Okay. We don't know. We really don't know. It could be that they didn't even get to it yet, or it could be that there's some real thinking going on. You know, there was a parallel case out of Kentucky that some of the briefing was due earlier in the month of February, so I tend to think that the justices like to think about these issues all at once, and so I think they'll probably consider it a couple more times before deciding to act on it. You know, by way of context for your listeners, the Supreme Court conferenced on Masterpiece Cake Shop. That was the case out of Colorado about whether or not a baker could turn away a refused service for a gay couple for a same-sex marriage. And the court considered that case 13 times before it decided to take it. So we could be here for a little while.
Okay. Okay. This is like the old game they played with Soviet watching. You know, you had these people who just...
I'm old enough to remember that.
You know, it was just they looked for clues because everything was so opaque in terms of what decisions were being made. And I guess you're kind of Supreme Court detective because you say they're not giving clues. And yet so much depends on what their decisions will be and even whether they will see cases. So I don't know. I noticed that built into that Dobbs decision was sort of another clause of it, which talks about it basically says that only a lesser group of people can even bring cases if the Supreme Court acts in favor of that clause. And that would mean that the woman herself, but not her doctor or her clinic, can bring the case if she is treated unfairly in terms of Roe versus Wade. And that might narrow who would be challenging unfair abortion laws in various states. So it seems to me that might be the direction they're going in, just the chipping. That would certainly be terrible, right? But do you have any sense that they kind of want to avoid that confrontation where, you know, Roe actually has to be decided again?
Yeah, this is the ultimate political question for conservatives, really, because as you've mentioned, this, you know, their ability to fundraise off of trying to overturn Roe versus Wade, or Democrats insisting that they're going to, you know, put a Planned Parenthood that provides abortion at every corner. You know, I mean, you know, all of the rhetoric that happens in these election cycles around abortion rights, and conservatives really benefit from that more so than Democrats and progressives. And so they would lose an electoral advantage, is definitely some of the conventional thinking around this. Should the Supreme Court strike the final death blow to Roe versus Wade? You know, the only thing, in my opinion, that does not consider is that even within the anti-choice circles, the needle has moved so far to the right. Everything is so much more extreme than even when I started in this space over a decade ago, that I don't know that they would, you know, there are so many ideologues, and it really is the ultimate prize for so many that at this point they may be willing to, you know, give the electoral advantage, if it even, you know, truly exists anymore for them, up, if it means that they ultimately do get to crow about recriminalizing abortion.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your conclusion on that to me, Jessica? It wasn't completely clear. What would be the electoral advantage?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the conventional wisdom is that conservatives have an electoral advantage so long as Roe versus Wade stays intact, because it's something that they very successfully fundraise off of, campaign off of, you know, okay. I mean, all of that. And so, you know, but within the anti-choice movement, even that has moved so far to the right that conventional thinking just may not be applicable anymore.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, we have the majority of people in this country wanting Roe versus Wade to be maintained, not wanting to be overturned. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like this is a last gasp of Republican-controlled states, right, before they too may go the way of the dinosaur, we hope.
Absolutely.
But so much damage can be done, yeah. What do you think of the EACH Act? Do you think that could really stop the court?
You know, I think that any of those kinds of legislative actions, whether it's the EACH Act, the Holman's Health Act, there are a couple of these legislative proposals to codify Roe and to expand abortion rights in places where in the states they've receded. These are all necessary things that have to happen while we have a Democratic administration in office. Otherwise, we really, truly are doomed. I mean, if we have the House, the Senate, and the presidency, and we cannot at a minimum protect abortion rights as a floor, which is really, in my opinion, what something like the EACH Act does. This is excellent, but that's not like the ultimate panacea for abortion rights. You know, this is where we really need to be working for a start and pushing folks, because what we know is that if the midterm elections don't go well, or if the next presidential elections go well, conservatives will be laser focused on abortion rights all over again.
That's right. Okay. The reason we are doing this segment, of course, is not to frighten people, although there's a lot to be frightened. When you look at the map of this country, you see how many states are poised to get rid of all abortion laws. I mean, outlaw abortion if Roe is overturned, and it's kind of scary. But to encourage people to realize that this is a moment that your participation and your activism is tremendously needed if you care about the right to control your body. And I just read an excellent piece by Jenny Brown in Portside saying we need to go back to the radical tactics by which we won these rights in the first place. People forget about that. They think the Supreme Court just gave it to us, but that's not true. There was a very, very ardent movement that forced that to happen. And so I would advise that people join their local groups fighting for women's rights, fighting for abortion rights. There are many, many groups. National Women's Liberation is an excellent one. But, you know, just joining now, supporting all of the groups that are struggling to keep the rights that we won. Any last words from you, Jessica?
I really love that is the last sort of word from you on this, that this is absolutely a moment for us to mobilize and a call to action, because it may feel dire, but we do have the ability to fight back and win. We see abortion rights as a consistently winning issue in elections. And so Democrats need to govern like we won, you know, and let's do this. So I really just think that that's a great call to action to end this.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on our airwaves once again, Jessica Mason Piegwo. And we'll be back in touch with you, and we'll be reading Rewire News Group. Check it out, folks. Take care.
Thanks so much.
And now we're going to go to some music. And when we come back, we're going to be speaking with Tyena Yen Amey about the other side of the surrogacy dispute. So please stay tuned.
Working hard out of my days for finer things in life. Happy life than one peaceful night. When I went out for a walk, a hand around my mouth, an intruder to the colors of my womb. Understand the facts of life. Broken home, love was rare and life a fight. Then I came across a young boy who would hold me tight and leave me lonely with the colors from my wound. Sometimes he could not tell the difference between night and day. Intoxicated days had rearranged his way. Then my father, my own father, took a turn one day from my mother to the colors of my womb.
And that is Colors of My Womb by Sweet Honey and the Rock. You're listening to Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. WBAI is at 99.5 FM. It is completely listener-supported. We have no commercial sponsors, and we really, really would appreciate any contribution you can make. If you make a contribution during our show for your favorite show, Joy of Resistance, and good radical feminist radio would really be appreciative of your support. You can call 516-620-3602 and make that contribution, or go to WBAI's website at givetowbai.org, and you'll see some wonderful, wonderful, wonderful gifts. So we are going to go to our next guest, who is Tyena Yen Amey. Tyena, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Fran. Thank you for having me.
It's great that you could come back and be on Joy of Resistance again. Let me just say that the New York State Surrogacy Act was ratified recently by the Senate after having been passed last year by the Assembly. It legalizes commercial surrogacy, meaning paying of women to become pregnant and bear children for clients willing to pay quite a bit of money overall. not necessarily to the woman, but certainly for the whole procedure, because it involves agencies, it involves all kinds of middle people. Okay, it's being hailed as a great step forward. It's already passed. It was pushed through without much debate last year, and it is made to seem that everybody loves it and thinks it's a great step forward, but that is not the case. You yourself, Tyuna Bienname, who is the director of the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women and a founder of Equality Now and a longtime activist in defending the rights of women, do not agree. Assemblywoman Deborah Glick, who is a very staunch supporter of all things progressive in the Assembly, Helene Weinstein, Dede Barrett, they do not agree, and they were publicly tongue-lashed by the governor because he was pushing hard for the bill's passage. The National Organization for Women, our nation's largest feminist organization, does not agree that this is a good thing, and it is also outlawed throughout much of Europe and in China and some other places. So we're going to be talking to you tonight about that other side that we haven't been hearing very much from. I think my cohort Halsey will lead off with a question to you, Tyuna.
Sure. Hi, and thanks so much for joining us. I guess I want to just start off by asking, first of all, about what is in this bill, right? Both the broad strokes, and also, as Fran mentioned, there are some safeguards that they say have been built in. So I'm wondering if you could talk us a little bit through what is in this law and if you think those safeguards are going to be enough.
Okay, so thanks again for having me. I just wanted to go back for your listeners to understand sort of the how this bill came to life. So there had been conversations around New York having this surrogacy bill. And in 2019, when Assemblywoman Amy Paulin and Senator Brad Hoylman really pushed for it, there was significant backlash. There was a letter that was signed by over 100 New York women leaders to the governor saying this is a terrible mistake. It would violate women's rights, women's reproductive integrity and health. As Fran said, there was a letter by the National Organization for Women there. We went up to Albany a few times, and until the last day of the 2019 legislative session, literally in June 2019, the bill was defeated. And that was in large part because of the leadership of the Assemblywomen that Fran mentioned. So fast forward in 2020, again, the bill comes forth, and again, the resistance rises. And we were about to go to Albany with a number of surrogate survivors and egg donor survivors. And then COVID happened. And in the middle of the night on April 2nd, when districts all over New York, as you know, it was the height of the COVID epidemic in New York, buried in a 400-page budget, Cuomo pushed for the surrogacy bill to be enacted. So it's pretty brutal at many, many levels. There were no public hearings. There were no legislative hearings. And basically what the law does, the law isn't meant to protect the surrogate mothers. It's not meant to protect the women's health or the women's lives or women's rights. It's really meant to protect a predatory reproductive technology industry. It allows them to match very wealthy people to women who are in economic straits and other forms of vulnerability to carry an embryo that is not hers. So there's a lot of Hallmark-looking bells and whistles around the promotion of the law, but in fact, it is not a law that is meant to protect women. It really is. As the late and great Mario Cuomo would say, an unconscionable contract that would be unenforceable.
Okay. So, yes, you and other people who are against this kind of commercial surrogacy or any kind refer to reproductive exploitation. Now, the people who are for it say, no, we've gotten rid of all that because the woman has her own lawyer, which the client will pay for, and she has health insurance that will cover all of her expenses, right? There's no exploitation. But can you make the case for why this is exploitation? And can you give examples that may be domestic or maybe foreign, coming from foreign countries?
Okay, so first, even the way you mentioned that her attorney will be paid for by the contracting parents, that in and of itself is not a recipe for, you know, independent decision-making, or should a problem arise, which often does, then how that person is going to be represented. And we've had many conversations with surrogates who've had contracts that really fell awry, because that's what contracts do. But in this case, we're talking about the life and the health of a mother. So one of the requirements for a surrogate mother is that she has to be a mother. She has to have given birth, right? So why do we call it reproductive trafficking, or at least something that leads to a high risk, not only of reproductive trafficking, but also reproductive tourism? So I'll just give you a few cases around the world. There's the baby factory case, where in 2014, this Japanese heir by the name of Mitsutoki Shigeta, at 28, had within 2 years 13 children that he contracted through 9 surrogates in Thailand. And a Thai court gave this very wealthy Japanese businessman sole custody. But that Interpol was looking into that. That is something that could happen here. This law will not protect that from happening. Also in 2014, there's the baby Gammy case, where one of the twins that an impoverished Thai mother gave birth to and was caring for an Australian couple was born with Down syndrome. So the Australian couple only took the girl twin, the girl who was healthy, and baby Gammy is still with the Thai mother. And then it later came out, or was reported, that the father was actually a convicted pedophile. So as a result of these cases, Thailand banned commercial surrogacy. Then just recently, because I can give you many examples in past years, but just in December 2020, at the height of the COVID epidemic, there were literally hundreds of surrogate babies who were lingering in clinics in Ukraine. Ukraine is known as the baby factory of Europe. So surrogacy [S2] Wow. [S1] Is banned in most countries in Europe. The European Parliament calls it a human rights violation against women and the ultimate commodification of women's bodies and women's health. So even then, the Ukrainian Commissioner for Children's Rights is now calling for a ban on surrogacy, stating that it violates children's rights and contributes to the sale of Ukrainian children. Just last month, there's this famous Chinese actress, Zhang Shuang, who was accused of having abandoned her 2 surrogate children who were born of American surrogates in the U.S. in December 2019 and January 2020. It caused a huge scandal. Commercial surrogacy is banned in China because China recognizes surrogacy as using women's bodies as commercial products for sale. So the law does not prevent any of these scenarios from happening. And because surrogacy is banned in, you know, not just across Europe, but also India, Cambodia, Nepal, et cetera, what that will do is New York has now created a market for those individuals, because you don't need to be married under the law. I know the governor was proclaiming that because we had marriage equality, then this was sort of a natural segue to offer rich gay couples the right to have a family, which no one has a right to a biological family, by the way. But the law does not require you to be married. So it's all very, very troublesome.
Yeah. Taina, I want to get into some of the class aspects of this, which really trouble me. We're talking about clients who are purchasing this service and paying something upwards of $150,000, right? Even though the woman isn't getting that, right? So you're talking about upper middle class people. And there is a great deal of I don't know what to call it, this kind of imagery that the women who are serving as the, quote, surrogates, and I actually hate that word because it doesn't have the word woman in it. You know, it's very depersonalized. But anyway, the women who are serving this, who are becoming pregnant for money, it doesn't really talk about what this would actually be worth if you used like OSHA standards or you used normal standards of labor practices. For instance, you're talking about 9 months of a woman's life, and that is night and day, that she could be subject to any number of conditions, right? She could have eclampsia or have, you know, the eggs was caught, you know, or she has to go through harvesting of eggs beforehand, which is dangerous. There's all kinds of very health challenging conditions here that are not being talked about. And when you think of what is being paid to the woman, which is something like $30,000, it's ridiculous if you put it on a per hour basis, when it seems to me that this is hazard pay should be being paid, the kind of pay that men get when they work in very hazardous conditions, such as oil rigs. So I just wanted to throw that out in terms of a big class issue, and I know that Halsey might have a question on that also.
Well, you know, we have to go back to the role of the state here, because we can't just focus on the woman, whether or not she consents or whether or not any person off the street would look at the image of who's doing the buying and who's doing the delivering of a baby and will see the stark economic inequality, where you have one party that needs at least $100,000 in disposable income, because it's not just the surrogate mother that's involved. There's also an egg donor, because a surrogate mother does not have the right to use her own eggs for the pregnancy. So there are two women involved, and so it's a lot of cost. And then on the other hand, you have a woman who is in an extremely vulnerable situation, right? We are talking about women who are in economic dire straits, who may have very, very vicarious situations in situations of could be debt bondage, could be a history of abuse, et cetera. So we have to go back to the state. So New York State likes to pride itself as being a leader in, there's a crisis in maternal mortality in New York. So it pledged to reduce maternal mortality. It's pledging to iron out economic inequalities to protect the vulnerable. But somehow, when it comes to protecting vulnerable women, especially in a surrogacy context or in an egg donation context, all of those goals go out the window. And so I think that that's the question. Mm-hmm. So instead of asking whether or not she consents to it, because of course women have a right to do what they want with their bodies, but what is the state's role in this, when it really, what it is doing through this law is giving a red carpet to a multi-billion dollar reproductive technology industry that is going to take full advantage of the most vulnerable women in New York. And also it's going to open up the demand for a market for surrogate mothers. And if we can't find all of the willing surrogate mothers here in New York, where will they come from? And so those are all elements that we need to think about. And also to go back to how they're claiming that New York has finally reached the 21st century by doing this. But it's actually the opposite when you see what's happening abroad. This is an extremely regressive law. I don't know whether your listeners know, have read or have seen the Handmaid's Tale series, but it's exactly that what the law does is that it protects the surrogate mother, quote, and I put quote unquote protect, until she delivers the infant. So just like in The Handmaid's Tale, she'll get special food. She may get special treatment. There are certain things she can do and can't do. It's all supposedly under informed consent. But the minute that this contract happens, the minute that she delivers it, who is she? No one knows because there is no state-mandated registry. The state will not know whether she suffers from postpartum depression or whether the health consequences from her high-risk pregnancies will produce lifelong medical treatment. And, you know, all of the surrogate mothers I've spoken with, they've all said, you know, of course, one, I was in desperate need of money, but I've been pregnant. I know what it was like to be pregnant, and I'm so happy to provide a baby to people who can't have one or who want one. But I didn't know. Nobody told me about the medical trauma that I would endure. Nobody told me about the psychological trauma.
Right.
I mean, they bond with this infant for 9 months, for 10 weeks, I mean, for 10 months, 40 weeks, if they're lucky.
Tyena, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it at that because we're just about out of time. I hope that you can come back and we can continue talking about this and maybe take some phone calls because I really don't like the kind of puff piece way that it's been handled by the media. There is another side. A very serious other side. And I thank you very much for coming on to Joy of Resistance and letting our listeners know about it. So
thank you so much
for your work.
Thank you to Joy of Resistance. Bye.
Yeah. Great. Good night. All right, folks, about wraps it up for Joy of Resistance tonight, February 22nd. Next month is Women's History Month, and we're going to be back to talk to you with some great Women's History Month packages and some great Women's History Month programming, and we look forward to you being back, and we look forward to doing the show. And let me say good night, and please remember to keep WBAI going. Call our pledge number 516-620-3602. She said, rushing out of the studio, so to speak. We look forward to encountering you in our next show. If you want to communicate with us, we are at JOR@WBAI.org. JOR for Joy of Resistance, JOR@WBAI.org. We'd love to hear your opinions on this. Okay, over and out, and good night. And we have some outro music. Okay.
Working hard out of my days for finer things in life. Happy life than one peaceful night when I went out for a walk, a hand around my mouth. An intruder to the colors of my womb. I was young and did not understand the facts of life. Broken home, love was rare and life a fight. Then I came across a young boy who would hold me tight and leave me lonely with the colors from my womb. Sometimes he could not tell the difference between night and day. Intoxicated days had rearranged his way. Then my father, my own father, took a turn one day from my mother to the colors of my womb.
Extinction Diaries. The Center for Biological Diversity is one of the most effective wildlife watchdogs on Earth. They are desperate to stop an extinction in progress of a little mouse that hibernates up to 9 months a year. The New Mexico meadow jumping mouse population in parts of the state are near zero, and the culprits are too visible. Ranchers have been caught illegally grazing hundreds of times on land protected for the meadow mouse. The U.S. Forest Service has failed to enforce the law or even give citations to lawbreakers. The center is demanding an investigation. investigation. 3 decades ago, the mouse was found in 17 streamside locations in southern New Mexico's Lincoln National Forest, and now they can be found in only one. In neighboring Arizona, environmental organizations had to sue the Forest Service to protect the meadow mouse in that state. The U.S. Forest Service mission statement reads as follows: to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of the nation's forests and grasslands to meet the needs of present and future generations. My name is Aaron Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
Radio Gag, the Gays Against Guns show.
Tune into Radio Gag at our new time, Tuesdays at 2:30 p.m.